I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Thanks a lot for joining us for today's podcast titled Coronavirus Facts Only. Every day around this time, I'm talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital about coronavirus and COVID-19. What do we need to know? How do we keep ourselves safe? And what lies ahead in the uncertain future? Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Oh, always happy to do so.
One of the big topics up for debate these days, Dr. Buchholz, is who should be wearing a mask. We've heard for some time now from the CDC and the World Health Organization that it's not necessary for people who are not sick to wear the mask. That won't protect them from getting the virus. It's more important for people that are sick and for the doctors and nurses to be wearing the masks. We just heard from Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the NIH, on CNN this morning, talking about that. He says the CDC is now taking a closer look at who should be wearing a mask.
The thing that has inhibited that a bit is to make sure that we don't take away the supply of masks from the healthcare workers who need them. But when we get in a situation where we have enough masks, I believe there will be some very serious consideration about more broadening this recommendation of using masks. We're not there yet, but I think we're close to coming to some determination, because if in fact a person who may or may not be infected wants to prevent infecting someone else, one of the best ways to do that is with a mask. So perhaps that's the way to go. That's under very active consideration. We'll be discussing it today, this afternoon, at the task force meeting.
What do you think, Dr. Buchholz? Who should be wearing a mask?
Well, let me preface this first by, if anybody's going to get masks, I think it should be healthcare providers first. As I've mentioned multiple times, this is a essential shortage that really is a massive struggle and piece of angst for providers and administrators and people all along that supply chain as well. So I think that's where the priority needs to go. I think when you look at all we know with COVID is basically what we know from previous experience and then what we know from as we're learning about this throughout the course of this. And, this is a national and international tragedy in many ways, but it's also, I think, led to some interesting things, too, about how we learn information and how we adapt. I think it's been a benefit in that standpoint of just how we're getting information, adapting. So previously, the literature showed that wearing masks did not really do much to prevent spread. This is particularly around the idea of influenza, with some kind of clear exceptions, but just amongst the general population, it does not seem to. I think, again, just like with social distancing, if everybody's wearing masks, then that reduces transmission to some degree. There might be a net benefit considering how quickly this spreads through a population if it's not separated and we don't take steps to reduce contamination. Like I said, that's the big if here is if there's enough supplies to do this. And currently right now there is not. And so I think we need to prioritize this. I think it would be a mistake from the CDC personally at this juncture. I do this reluctantly. I mean, I've talked with a couple of my colleagues the last couple of days about just this is a very weird time because we're not sure the CDC has been absolutely correct in what their guidelines are. It's not saying I know more than the CDC. I really don't. There's some incredible talent there. But, this whole idea of wearing a particular type of mask and that's changed to another type of mask in the healthcare setting purely because of supplies has led to this kind of mistrust about what the right piece of equipment is to protect us. Is a surgical mask sufficient to protect, an individual from seeing a patient with COVID from getting sick themselves? Or are these more higher-end N95 masks the best use? And the truth is nobody really knows, and probably the surgical mask is okay. But because the CDC has kind of gone back and forth, and there's been a question of, whether lawyers or other administrators got involved in making these decisions, kind of makes us trust them less. And that, to me, is a a concerning thing. And so when the CDC says these things, the question I have, is this a political thing, and a political decision, or a decision for the behalf of the health of the United States? And, you know, I that to me is the hardest part about this. And like I said, if people, again, I have a conflict of interest, so I'm worried about my colleagues, my friends, and probably myself too, but more worried about just the general health of the healthcare workforce. We need those masks first. That's where we're really on the front lines of dealing with this. This is like, to me, like arming the population in the United States before you arm the military at World War II. It just, that has just no logic to it. And you know, we need to make sure the people that are in the highest risk areas are getting these first before we do it, you know, across the entire population.
So I guess we'll just have to stay tuned to find out what the latest thinking is on that.
Yeah, and again, the news reports are like they're discussing that, which is, again, I think it's perfectly fine to discuss that and really kind of go through the pluses and minuses. I mean, just like the president was talking about maybe earlier, or stopping the social distancing early, you know, that's a discussion. He came out and said this is an idea, but was an official policy. And, you know, I'm pleased that they walked that back a little bit and said, no, we need to kind of keep this going for a little bit longer. You know, again, there's a difference between discussing things and kind of going through all the options, which I think is important to good decision making, and then actually come up with policy that really has taken that decision making to the next level and said, here's what we, based on our best guesses and evidence, this is what we think is the best thing forward. So, again, if we had the supplies to do it, I don't think it would be a horrible thing. If we don't have the supplies, I think it's premature.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a slew care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, yesterday President Trump said we have now reached 1 million Americans that have been tested for the coronavirus. Is that a good start?
Well, I don't know how to answer that question. I think it's good we're testing people. I think it's good that we're able to test more and more people. I think the thing that's really frustrating about this as well is, you know, in my own institution, we had to develop our own test, and our colleagues at Barnes Jewish also had to develop their own test. So it's not like, you know, we've had this massive national surge to get testing that was led by the people that we normally expect to do this. This has just all been our local ad hoc kind of development. And an issue we're dealing with now with that is when we get a negative test and we have a high suspicion, it's hard to know what to do with that. And in fact, we're more often than not testing again just to make sure. We don't know how accurate that test is yet. And so there's still a lot of unknowns that makes decision-making uncomfortable and challenging. And, you know, some of us, myself included, and I'm not sure I'm right on this, but, you know, I'm advocating to test pretty much everybody that walks in the healthcare setting. You know, I'd like to test our providers a couple times a week. I'd like to test our patients as they walk in the door. And, you know, if we had rapid testing on this where you get the answer pretty quickly, that'd be very, very helpful. And we're just not there yet. And we're not there yet to test, you know, everybody that walks in. We just have to still have a decent index of suspicion, which, you know, as we're finding out, particularly experience in America, and, you know, the group out of Seattle at University of Washington just put out a paper this morning, maybe last night. You know, this is happening in a different set of people than what we're used to. That's been our experience in my own institution, is people that don't meet that criteria right away, they're sick basically for other reasons. We end up just kind of thinking, well, maybe we should test them because we can't explain why they're sick, and they end up having a positive test. And so the population of people that are getting sick is a bit different than what previous experience has been. And again, this is just, again, as we are learning about this, and I think the people that are really, really high risk that were identified in China might be just staying away and being very, very cautious about what they're doing, which I applaud them for. And so, like, a second level of people are now getting sick, and we're seeing that. So, you know, that's just kind of a very small anecdotal experience, but it, again, goes to that point of, we really like to have more testing. It's not enough yet. There's nothing to be celebratory about having a million tests. We need to have 10 million, 20 million to really kind of get a handle on this and see what's going on.
The FDA has just approved a new 5-minute point of service test. How welcome is that, and how would that work?
Oh, that'd be phenomenal. And again, just to that same point of, you know, when we have any kind of suspicion, deploying a test, knowing what we're doing, limiting the exposure of providers so we have a good idea, provided it has a sensitivity that it needs to have, would be phenomenal, and really just answer a lot of questions quickly. It sounds like they're going to deploy this first to kind of the hardest hit areas, which, you know, again, I'm a little sad to see as a St. Louisan, but I think that's a smart decision, and deploy it where it's needed the most is, you know, seems like the appropriate decision. But I certainly, hopefully they can ramp up production and we can get testing in our facility and hopefully within the region as well. I think even if I'd be willing to trade a little bit of accuracy for the rapidity of the test, I think that's really, really important. And at that point, we can just test people as they come in the hospital, we know, and then we can isolate and do what we need to do right away, which would buy us a lot of time and effort and equipment.
The governor of Virginia has issued a stay-at-home order in his state through June 10th. Is that too long, or you think that's more realistic?
I think it's somewhat realistic. I think, you know, the experience in Wuhan says they're just now starting to lift this, and it's been about 3 months. I think it's certainly, you know, I've said multiple times here, prepare for the worst and hope for the best. So, you know, by doing that, you at least give people a sense that this is more of a longer game than just a couple weeks, which I think that's a reality we've got to get used to. And when I've talked to my own group, I'm trying to kind of coach them along with that to say, hey, this is not going to be a couple weeks and then it's over. This is going to be months, and then we have to be prepared for that. You know, behind that is always the idea of, you know, if they rescind it in mid-May, they look really great. So, you know, there's some psychological benefit to that. But I think all of us should be prepared, you know, going into the summer, kind of being this stay-at-home type of order. I think this is a reality for the next couple of months that we just need to get used to. I don't think, certainly has not reached its peak yet. And so I think locally, you know, I think anticipating when that will occur and being ready to deal with that is, you know, something that should be on our minds. And so I don't think you can really start to think about receiving those orders till you clearly have not only flattened that curve and you've reached your peak, but you're starting to see a decrease in cases such that it's safe to kind of mingle with others again. So I think it's forward thinking. I'm sure he's going to get some political heat for making it that long, but I think it also provides businesses and other people clarity about how this might last, and, you know, not hold on to desperate hopes that we'll be back to normal in a month, because I think that's highly unlikely, personally.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, seasonal flu numbers in this area seem to be dropping a bit. Is that a sign that social distancing is working there too?
You know, that's another really great question. It's hard to know, and I would say probably yes. You know, this is kind of the time where flu season starts to wane a little bit too, in the kind of its natural cycle. But I think there's probably a bit of overlap. Yeah. Cause again, flu spread very similar ways, you know, aerosolized contents from the nose and mouth typically, and getting other people infected in a densely populated area. So there's probably a component of that. Absolutely.
Last week, we heard about some new possible symptoms for coronavirus, including a loss of taste and a loss of smell. A few days ago, we heard about a new one, pink eye. What are you hearing about that?
Well, and again, I think this is in a small component of patients. You know, again, this is a virus, and any kind of open, the word we use is mucosal, or it just is basically the type of cells it affects is also on our eyes. So I'm not shocked by that at all. Again, if you had pink eye as a result of COVID-19, that would be something I would not think is going to lead to serious disease. And again, same measures applies if you have the sniffles or sneezes, is just, you know, stay at home, avoid contact with others, wash your hands frequently, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not surprising. And it probably, again, like with all these other symptoms, probably occurs in the minority of patients, you know, 5 to 15%, if that's the case.
And remind us of the main symptoms.
Yeah, so again, most patients will have, you know, fairly mild symptoms. So, you know, what I call upper respiratory symptoms. So sneezing, congestion, sore throat. You may feel kind of wiped out or fatigued, and the word we use for that is malaise. You know, and that the same symptoms as the flu, the same symptoms sometimes as allergies as well. So it's hard to tell, but the patients with those symptoms typically don't progress to the more severe form of coronavirus infection. Certainly, what I would call lower respiratory symptoms. So again, that idea of malaise, fever, although, again, the Seattle experience showed that fever may not be as consistent as we initially thought, but fever is certainly a component of that. And then, you know, certainly kind of a deeper cough, a cough coming from the lower part of the lungs, and shortness of breath are really kind of the more the signal concerning signs that warrant medical attention and probably will get us to pay attention and look at you. I think if you feel sick for other reasons, and particularly I think, again, the Seattle experience and kind of our own anecdotal experiences, if you're diabetic and not feeling well, and you're short of breath, that tends to be the patients we've seen so far, and that's what Seattle saw quite a bit. Certainly older with those symptoms, and when I say older, age above the age of 65, and forgive me for that, but you know, those are people we get worried about. But again, we've seen lots of middle age and even younger people with symptoms and shortness of breath requiring support. So I think that shortness of breath or feeling really, really bad are probably the two signal symptoms to, you know, come and seek medical attention.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a slew care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, we've been hearing about in St. Louis City, a homeless man was found to have a positive case of COVID-19, and he refused treatment at a hospital and left the hospital. How concerning is something like this?
Well, you know, let me just preface this by saying, you know, unfortunately, our population of homeless in St. Louis often have a lot of comorbid illnesses, so they'll often have psychiatric illnesses and other massive issues. It makes it very difficult to treat them in any stretch of imagination. And then, you know, with public health issues, we have to kind of balance that need for patient autonomy. So, you know, when I take care of a patient in the hospital, it's always their option to leave. I can't force them to stay unless they're a clear danger to themselves, versus a public health need and, you know, where that risk of that person getting other people sick. And again, if he's in contact with other people with a similar population, you can just kind of imagine how quickly it all spread like wildfire. And it's certainly concerning. So, you know, this is where I think whether or not you keep this person is an issue of public health concern. I think that's up to each public health entity, so the State Department of Public Health, the city, and then the county if this patient's in the county. But we've had this discussion, too. So, you know, at our institution, you know, we have a fair amount of people we have the privilege to take care of who are, you know, have difficulty paying bills and may need additional support. And, you know, if we're ready to discharge this person from hospital, say they're positive for COVID, the facilities we usually would send to help care for them as they transition out of hospital are fairly reluctant to take these patients, understandably. They don't want to get their other patients sick. And we don't really feel good about sending them home or back to a homeless shelter. I wouldn't say feel good. You know, we would have a massive issue doing that. What do we do with those patients in the interim? That's been a discussion we've been having. It's a really good question one of my residents posed. And I think the short answer is nobody knows. Again, this is the flaw of our healthcare system is we have all these little loopholes and holes that, you know, where people who are vulnerable, you know, kind of have it's issues. We have issues getting them the care they need. So I don't know the particular situation with the homeless individual, what the circumstances of them leaving. I think if they were COVID positive, I think there's a public health need to keep them ensure that they're separated so they don't get others sick. But the rules we have now are self-quarantine. So it's up to the individual. We can't force them to stay against their will, as far as I know. I don't know if that will change or not. But it's a really good question. It's a really good and concerning problem. And I think something we're going to have to sort through, and it's going to occur more as we sort through this and what to do.
I have a listener question for you. This listener wants to know, she saw her elderly neighbor being taken to the hospital by ambulance with a possible case of pneumonia. Could that be COVID-19, and are the symptoms similar?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the overlap is incredibly significant. And, you know, I without knowing anything about that person's history, I'm sure they were tested when they came to the hospital. So, yes, I mean, pneumonia, all that is it's an infection of the lungs. And so traditionally and fairly commonly, these are caused by bacteria, which is a type of cellular organism. Those are the types of things we treat with antibiotics. COVID is a virus, which is a different thing that can also cause pneumonia. And again, certainly with these patients and the ones that are getting sick with respiratory symptoms, they are causing a type of viral pneumonia. And there's lots of different types and different ways it looks on our imaging. The approach is still the same. Treat with respiratory support. So if need be, put them on the ventilator to help them breathe. And, you know, treat with the appropriate medications as we need to. And you have to make a decision whether or not to give antibiotics or not. I think most people would, even if they suspect COVID. But until the COVID test gets back. So, yeah, this person, I am sure the symptoms are very similar, and it's hard to discern it. It's purely a clinical diagnosis. This is, you know, how to treat and diagnose and think about pneumonias, what separates the internists from, you know, the non-internists, I guess. That's kind of our bread and butter and what we really pride ourselves on doing.
Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot again for your time. Really do appreciate it.
No, thank you. Appreciate it, Fred. Thanks.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU Care General Internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Thanks so much for joining us for today's podcast, Coronavirus Facts Only. Talk to you again tomorrow.